we turn to the two thinkers and pundits and individuals who are described in your brochure. Both Matt and Jamie each have their own podcast. They each write at a number of different outlets and appear on a number of talk shows. And what we thought we'd do is have about a maybe 30 or 40 minute conversation and then throw it over to you. So we've got four or five questions prepared for them. The first of which is to ask a little bit about your early start. I know that you guys both overlapped at Daily Caller at one point together with Tucker Carlson and others. And in your sort of first decade of writing and work, curious as to whether there's perhaps an event or an encounter that surprised you or stood out as being something that you're proud of as a stronger achievement sort of as you're getting going. And the idea there is what Chris Smith described as Aristotelian eudaimonia, real contentment, not erroneous pride, but something that you're proud of.
Well, I would say first, one of the things that surprised me, it's not something I'm proud of, but it's how tough this business is and how much it changes. And so, I worked for 2 years at townhall.com, and I was really happy there, and then they had a change in how they did things, and I clearly saw that it was time for me to go because my boss got fired, and when your boss gets fired, oftentimes you're next. And so I went to work at a place called AOL's Politics Daily, and I was super happy there. And I woke up one morning to find out that the Huffington Post AOL had bought the Huffington Post for $315 million, and Arianna Huffington would soon be my boss. And, of course, almost all my colleagues, except for two, were quickly gone. And so what I learned is just how tough the business is. That was kind of a big surprise or awakening for me. And that informed a lot of the decisions I made that maybe we'll get into some of them. I would say in terms of something that I'm sort of, proud of that I thought was a really cool moment for me, and it was getting to ride on the Straight Talk Express with John McCain in New Hampshire, sadly not in 2000, but in 2008. Not something that I did that I'm going to be nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for, but just an amazing experience. My dad was a prison guard for 30 years in Hagerstown, Maryland, and the idea that I got to sit next to McCain and ask him questions was pretty amazing. And I have to say, in hindsight, it's even cooler than it was at the time, looking back. So for me, all the ups and downs, all of the competition, dangers of this business and this industry, it's also incredibly rewarding to get a chance to be around really amazing people.
First, let me just say that I looked over everyone's bios, so I'm a little humbled here. You are as qualified or more qualified to give me advice, I think, than I am to give you advice. I started kind of my career in the media as an opinion journalist. I was a college columnist. I came to D.C. as a collegiate network journalism fellow at Roll Call Newspaper. I wrote there and worked for, or was the assistant of Mort Kondracki, who was at the time a well-known columnist, TV presence. He had a TV show on Fox News. I ultimately went to grad school in London, continued writing while I was there, came back, started in the early days at the Daily Caller, where I did many different things. I guess I would call myself an opinion journalist. I wrote columns. I wrote reported pieces from the campaign trail. I did a lot of television and satirical work. I would say that kind of my roles changed a little bit in the 2016 election. I thought kind of that vitriol that I saw during that campaign kind of changed my focus a little bit and led me to answer your question, what I'm most proud of, which is the podcast I started in the midst of it, which I continue today, which is kind of my Bigfoot that remains in the journalism world. And what I have tried to do on that podcast is foster in-depth, non-hot take conversations with people all over the ideological spectrum, from, I like to say, Roger Stone to Ta-Nehisi Coates, which is a lot in the middle there. That's what we do. It's kind of just really sincere and gracious disagreements. At least that's what I try to do. Sometimes it doesn't always work out that way. And if you ask me what I'm most proud of, I guess it would be the conversations that I've been able to have on that show.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could pick up on that a little bit with the blend of writing, opinion writing, and hosting a podcast and getting on TV to advance ideas as well. You know, what do you see as being the sort of strengths and weaknesses, you know, hazards of those different platforms? You know, for somebody who is in their first or second decade as a journalist and just getting going, you know, is it important to push yourself and get, you know, get into one of those three perhaps areas that you haven't done if you're just primarily writing or reporting and the like, and why?
I think the nature of the media business and politics now is kind of incentive-based. So I still do television. I used to do more of it before the 2016 campaigns. But there's kind of a expectation when you go on TV to fit the narrative of whatever network you're on. And it's not just Fox News. It's all over the place. And if you don't fit that narrative, you're probably not going to come on too much. So I think TV's great, and so there are great people that go on that, especially. But you do lose something a little bit when you're trying to write to fit, you know, get that next television hit. So I think you should proceed cautiously. And there's nothing wrong with television, but I do think that, and it's not just television, I think that to be careful of just pandering to a certain audience because that's what gets clicks or that's what gets views. But unfortunately, the business model of most publications these days push you towards that way.
So my philosophy is, Jamie and I have both had what you might consider to be unorthodox journalism careers, and we're both like opinion journalists, and neither of us did it the way that like you might recommend doing it. Neither of us are straight reporters. Neither of us like went to work at the New York Times or the Washington Post. And if you can do that, then more power to you, and you probably don't need our advice. And maybe you can just make it with one outlet. My experience has been that for me to remain relevant and gainfully employed is to view it in a somewhat entrepreneurial standpoint. And along those lines, what I've found is a couple things. Well, I found that you need diversification and to be platform agnostic. And I think there are a few different reasons for that. One, the way people consume information nowadays is not simply reading the newspapers. And so if your only means of communicating with people is by virtue of your writing, then you are not reaching your potential to reach people. People watch video. People listen to podcasts. People read books. People listen to speeches. And so if you are depriving yourself of those different platforms, then you are, to some degree, limiting your ability to communicate. The other reason, I think, is that these different media have different skews. I think that some of them tend to be more superficial. Some of them tend to be more substantive. And I can tell you, as someone who wants to have a career and wants to be able to do this for many years, not only is it important for me to be able to reach people, but it's important for me to like not go insane and to not become a bad person. And if all I did was cable TV hits, I don't know how happy I would be, how contented I would be. And so I feel like having a balanced diet of different types of media really helps me stay grounded. And some of them, like having an hour-long long-form conversation with somebody with a policy wonk, is maybe more soul-nourishing than doing a 10-second radio, you know, radio hit. But, you know, I think it was George Clooney who makes blockbuster movies, but then he also makes these art house films, said, you know, I do one for them and one for me. Some of the things we do pay the bills. Some of the things we do scratch our artistic itch. Hopefully everything you do is something that you can be somewhat proud of or at least not ashamed of. But there are different media that lend themselves to different levels of being proud I would say, to go back to your first question. The last thing I would say, from a at some point this becomes a career. You have a mortgage, you have a spouse, you have kids, and that doesn't, I'm not an advocate of selling out. I think that you have to work to keep it fresh, to keep it fun, but you also need to make money. And I thought about what I do, which again is different. I'm not a straight reporter. I'm an opinion journalist and a commentator. But it's hard to make a living doing what we do for a variety of reasons, including the fact that everybody wants to do it and they're willing to do it for free. And so the way I've thought of it is essentially income streams, right? If you can get paid to write a column and be a TV contributor and get paid to write books and give speeches, or you know, which is where the real money is, you know, get a speaker's bureau and be an adjunct professor somewhere, which doesn't pay that well, and or work at a think tank as a fellow, you can now cobble together a pretty good living. And there are only a couple people who I think check all the boxes. E.J. Dionne, I think, checks every. He's got, but you don't have to like have every income stream working. But I do say, if you only have one, it's like having only one artery working. You know, you're going to have a heart attack. Now, unless you're like, if you're Malcolm Gladwell, well, even he has a podcast, right? But if you're Michael Lewis, you can probably just be a book writer, but for everyone else, you might want to think about diversification.
Question about liturgies or friendship, sort of the friendship-faith dynamic a little bit as well to ask about. So it feels like every time I have a meeting with a journalist, you guys are having lunch together.
so you just bump into us at restaurants,
yeah,
right?
And but you have a friendship that seems to have abided for many years, which is very respectable. There are a few of those in this town, and you also are each married, and I understand, Jamie in particular, you and your wife, Michelle, host a little dinner group sometimes. I'm curious about, you know, what you can tell us about sort of the liturgy or the importance of that kind of broader fellowship and friendship and engagement, and how, if at all, it helps in the professional space to have relationships that continue on.
Well, certainly, you know, Matt and I do lunch. We try to do lunch once every week or once every 2 weeks, I think for me, we see things similarly. So we're able to like go back and forth, especially with our careers. And he has good ideas that he'll throw at me, and I sometimes have somewhat okay ideas that I throw at him. And it kind of keeps things fresh and makes us think. It's good. It's kind of like, you know, go to a writer's room in the comedy writing world, and you kind of sit in a room, and people just go back and forth, and ultimately you get like the genesis of an episode of a TV show, because people keep adding to it and helping grow a concept, an idea, and an episode. So that kind of is the equivalent, I guess, of maintaining relationships. I have this dinner society that I do, which is a little different, I think. But it's a way of, among other things, you meet a lot of people at a somewhat regular basis in kind of your same world, and see what they're doing, kind of learn from them. Maybe if you're generous, you help other people learn as well. But it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. So I think it's always good to find a peer group that's involved in similar things where you can bounce ideas off of. It helps kind of the creative process.
Yeah, so I would say a couple things. One is, I do think that when you're young, people tell you, you got to go out and network, go to happy hours, talk to people. Well, maybe you're the kind of person who can do that, maybe you're not. It's not really my strength, and you know, you should at some point try things out and stretch yourself. If you're an introvert, maybe stretch yourself. But at some point, you kind of know who you are, and maybe that's not your scene. And I do think that we are called to certain people, that there are people who will give us energy and there are people who will take energy from us. And if you can find someone, Jamie and I have an announcement to make. if you find that one person in your life, that special person that you can have lunch with once a week, and it sparks joy and creativity and ideas, then you should do that. Because that's rare when you can find people in your life that will help give you energy and ideas. And so do lunch instead of spreading yourself really thin, like, you know, have lunch with that person regularly, and it's a win-win. I would also say, I think that friendships and other non-political things. I mean, Jamie and I, we certainly talk shop, but it's not. It's also a personal friendship, and I think it's really important to have those. So for me, for example, I mean, I can just tell you there are times when I'm. You know, there was like 1 year where I was like being flown to New York every single week. I was on prime time 2 or 3 nights a week on Anderson Cooper. And then there are times where the phone doesn't ring for weeks, you know. And if I found my identity and if my value came from whether or not I was hot at that moment, then I would be susceptible to like depression and when things aren't going well. And that's the danger of, I see people who really throw themselves into their work 100%. They're workaholics and they don't have this infrastructure. And so I have a wife who could not care less if I'm on TV or what I do, not impressed whatsoever with anything. And sometimes that's a little disappointing, but it's mostly great because then when things go bad, she also doesn't care. You know, not going to like leave me because my career, you know, because I'm canceled for some tweet I sent. You know, have a church, have a place of worship, have real friends who actually like you, not just because of who you are or where you work. If you're solely defining your value and your worth and your identity by being a writer, a reporter, a journalist, a TV person, whatever, and you're setting yourself up for failure. So make friends.
And what is your best piece of advice right before you get on to Bill Maher's show, which you've each done, for how to stay centered and calm and grounded and actually have something to contribute and be helpful in a context like that? How does your ecosystem of friendships and not just being a lone truth-seeking journalist play in a moment like that?
Well, you know, I mean, my view of those type of things is that if you just don't consider the crowd and engage as if you're in a conversation, it kind of happens organically. You forget the cameras in a certain way are there. So, I mean, that's kind of just technical advice. It's just my best piece of advice. Obviously, you always need to be prepared. Think, second order of questions. You know, if you say this, what will they say? How can you respond? It happens with my podcast a lot. In fact, I just recorded one yesterday where I kind of anticipate what the guest will say. I kind of, you know, so I have a kind of like lure them in sometimes, and that's not a right word, but maybe occasionally you'll lure them in, and then you kind of get it. It was perfect. I was waiting him for to say exactly what he said, and then kind of pose a question based on that. So kind of just think second order effects. You know, if you say this, what would you know that your interviewer come back with, and what will you have to ask him after that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's an interesting thing as a conservative-leaning dude going into that show is a little bit fraught with danger. I think I've done it 4 times. The last time was by far my most successful time, and I think it's partly because Bill Maher himself has kind of turned against the radical left, the cancel culture. So the vibe changed and the whole context changed. But, I mean, one time I was going in, and I'm going there to talk about like the 2016 election, which was a pretty good, since I was not a Trump fan, it would have probably been a fairly easy gig for me. And then there was a shooting like while I was on the plane, the Mother Emanuel Church shooting. So I spend an hour, you know, Matt Lewis hardest hit, right? I don't want to complain. There were a lot of other people who were, their lives were upended. But from my little my little standpoint, now all of a sudden, the next night, I'm on like an hour-long show where the focus is on like white supremacy and gun violence, and you know, tough gig being like the token conservative on that night. So you never know what's going to happen. But to your point about leveraging connections and relationships, you know, the first time I went on, I went to Tucker Carlson, who used to do Politically Incorrect all the time with Bill Maher, and got advice from him. And his advice was, get in early, like jump in, like don't wait for Bill to get, by the time he gets around to you, the whole narrative could be said. You need to like, it's sort of almost like a football game or a boxing match where you kind of want to get hit early and just get in there, get in the mix. Then I've also mentored other people. I think the last time I was on, I might have called Mary Catherine Hamm and got advice, or Amanda Carpenter, someone like that, and got someone who had recently done well. So I definitely knowing other people and having a network of friends that you can pick their brain is incredibly helpful.
And now I think of it, you may have told me to jump in early when I first went on.
Pay it forward. Did it work? That's the question.
Yeah, I think okay. So. It sets the pace.
Yeah.
I mean, among many things.
I mean, if there's like five people on a panel and you wait around and they happen to come to you, it could be like 10 minutes. Look, there was a part of the debate last night where like Elizabeth Warren disappeared for like 45 minutes. I think she like went out for a burger or something, right? Maybe she should have taken that advice.
You got to be careful what you jump in early. If you jump in early with like 9/11 was an inside job or something, right? Even the jumping early part can't overcome something like that.
You should have told me that before the Bill Maher show.
Not the kind of attention. With that encouragement to consider a blitz, note that this is the last question I've got, and then we're going to throw it over and open to the room to engage both of these guys. So wondering if you just might conclude one more comment with your sense of the political moment. I understand, Matt, that the real work of being a journalist involves writing an article after last night's debate,
yes,
submitting it, interacting with your editor several times in the night, and then eventually coming to this conference. So we appreciate your early morning. So there's a lot of real work to it. But what is your sense? I mean, you've been in Washington for several years and for a decade, you know, respectively, of where we are. Is politics gobbling up a lot more of the space that used to be available for other topics to write about and report on? How do you see today?
I think we live in an extraordinarily polarized moment where you have people kind of going into their corners and kind of radicalizing on both sides. But I do wonder, and I don't have the answer to this, to what extent is that most of the country as opposed to a narrow band of people that exist on Twitter. So I do think those who are the most engaged are very polarized, and there's not much in between or space for those in between or space for... I mean, we see during this Democratic campaign, a lot of people believe that the way to win is go very far to the left. Joe Biden's trying to do something different, saying that, you know, we can work together as Republicans and Democrats. That's hardly an endorsement of Joe Biden, but I'm just saying it's a question of whether that... A lot of people question whether that approach is even possible. And he's testing it, and I think he is testing what my notion is whether what we see as kind of America is right now is Twitter, when in reality that's a very, very small portion of America. And that's what I'm kind of intrigued by right now.
Yeah, it's a small portion, but it's an important portion, because I think that if the election were held tomorrow, let's say, or if it had been held 6 months ago, then what Twitter says about Joe Biden might not have mattered as much because it was out of touch. It is more white and more progressive than the Democratic electorate, even. The Democratic electorate is more moderate and pragmatic than Twitter would suppose. But I think the problem is that that over time, Twitter is driving the discussion, and that it eventually seeps down into the grassroots and everywhere else. So technology is really changing things. I am very concerned about the country, about our politics. But since I'm talking to a bunch of journalists and aspiring journalists and practicing journalists, I'll look at it sort of from that... from my own personal standpoint, which is to say, I'm having a hard time following the thread. It's challenging. Now, I'm a Gen X person. We're not even going to get a president. You know that, right? They're going to skip right over. We got so screwed. We're just going to elect baby boomers and go straight to the millennials. But the problem I have is that even though I'm not doddering, I still came of age at a time where things kind of made sense. I remember when there were just three networks, three TV channels, essentially. And the whole post-World War II 20th century paradigm, the left versus right thing that I'm very comfortable with. And I would say that it is a challenge For me, because we now live in this post-truth, anti-hero, post-modern, 24/7 cable news, weird world, and it's a challenge for me as someone who's ostensibly like a commentator about culture and politics to keep up with what's going on. And you guys may be better prepared to do that, but your time's coming too. There's going to be holograms and driverless cars. And I would just challenge, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to challenge you to find ways to reinvent yourself, to stay relevant, to stay gainfully employed, to not lose your soul, to not lose your passion, and to be aware that the world is going to look dramatically different and you're going to have to find a way to continue to have a voice. If you want to stay in this business, it's really tough. And here I am. I'm still as the notorious RBG says, and Eddie Vedder, I'm still alive and I'm still doing it. So for the next, you know, for the next 15 minutes at least, I'm in this game. That's it. Please applaud. Please call.
I'll just add one thing. I tend to agree with you. I'll go back to my Twitter point, which still fascinates me and still, I think, needs to be, we'll have to learn more about it. I agree that it shapes opinion to an extent, but the only place I ever see that Dave Chappelle is not funny is on Twitter. And that doesn't manifest itself in his audiences, which are sold out time after time and again. So that opinion exists like in this online world of Twitter, but it doesn't affect the real world at all, where Dave Chappelle has never had probably not a sold-out show in the last decade. So I do wonder how much effect in kind of the non-Twitter world
I worry that this elite progressive opinion does over time shift the Overton window, and that at some point, like if you like Dave Chappelle, then you're the problem, you know, and then maybe we can't hire you. You can't speak at our Faith Angle Forum anymore.
He would be a great guest for the Faith
Angle. Good word.
We are pleased to have not just journalists from San Francisco and New York and Washington, D.C., but also journalists in the room from Tennessee and Chicago and a number of parts of different parts of the country. Over to you. Feel free to get in. Who's up? Emily Bills.
So I work for a magazine that comes from a particular viewpoint, and sometimes I question the value of that as journalism, to have kind of advocacy journalism. And I know that's increasingly the nature of the industry. But I just wonder, from your perspective, what is the justification that you tell to yourself that this is a worthwhile thing to do?
So I think there's advantages sometimes being at a what's the publication you work for?
World Magazine. Okay. It's a Christian news magazine.
So what I tell people sometimes, especially really young writers who are just starting, that are working for a publication that might have an ideological bent, is that, well, you have an advantage if you're actually wanting just to do journalism, not opinion journalism or something like that, or even if you're trying to do opinion journalism, is that you're more likely to be able to get someone on the phone than who might think this is like a safe interview and ask the question that everyone wants to know, no matter whether you're left, right, or center. And that is a way to make a name for yourself. You're doing something that you can get someone on the phone and ask that question where someone else might not. World Magazine is a religious magazine, right? Like,
yeah,
you might be able to get, you know, Falwell on the phone if people are asking it and ask a question that everyone's been wanting to get.
Not him in particular.
Okay, I'm not so familiar with the intricacies of that, but my point is the same. So I think there's an advantage there, and I think there's a lot of great journalism that comes from some of these publications. Speaking of, forget the guy's name, he worked for Mother Jones, he wrote a book on the Koch brothers. You would think that would be a very partisan book. It was a tremendous work of journalism that he wrote. Very fair. So, there's great journalists working even at publications that have a mission and things along those lines. So I would say that sometimes there's an advantage to be working at publications where there is some ideological bent. That's not always the case, it is not rare.
So I would say a couple things. One, advocacy is great. My problem is with pandering, and I think that's the line. It's fine to work in an advocacy outlet, not fine to work at a pandering outlet, at least if that's your gig. Because I'm a believer that you could work at an outlet. Like George, I don't get mad at George Will if the Washington Post says something. You know what I mean? So there's different people at different outlets who have different callings and different missions and all that. But by and large, pandering's the problem, not advocacy. Advocacy's great. I mean, as long as you're being transparent and open about it, it's fine. Pandering's the problem, and I do worry that what we're having now is just an increasing of these the incentive is to pander because that's how you get ratings and buzz and profits, and that even mainstream media outlets are realizing who their base is, who their audience is, and giving them that sort of content for business reasons, not for journalistic reasons. And I think that is a huge, huge problem. But I think that if you're working at an outlet that is like explicitly Christian or religious or conservative or liberal, that's perfectly awesome if you are being intellectually honest about it, if they're being intellectually honest about it. I've worked at places like The Daily Beast and CNN and AOL as their conservative, one of their conservative voices. I've also worked at The Daily Caller for 6 years as their never Trump, one of their never Trump voices, even before Trump came along, sort of as someone who was pushing back against the populist, nationalist strain that was emerging at that time in conservatism. And the thing that they all have in common is that I don't want to say speaking truth to power, but that I am essentially pushing an argument to an audience that doesn't necessarily want to hear it. So if I'm writing for the Daily Beast, I'm not going to defend Donald Trump, probably, but I might say, like, look, pro-lifers have a really good argument, and let me tell you why I'm pro-life, and let me try to persuade you at least that I'm not evil or crazy. And I think that there's a value in pushing people to examine their priors and to think different. And I think the same thing at the Daily Caller when I was pushing people to say, like, maybe Ted Cruz shouldn't shut down the government. Like, maybe that's stupid. I was challenging them. And then the last thing I would say is that I do think that one could argue that you have a greater responsibility or calling to talk to your own side and to your own people. And that, like, there's a journalist named Katie Herzog out in Seattle who is a lesbian progressive, but she spends most of her time criticizing the radicalism of the left these days. And she says that even though, you know, she agrees with progressives on almost everything, she feels like it's her calling, part of her responsibility is to police her side of the street, and that's where she has influence. I think that's a pretty legitimate argument.
Not to toot my own horn, but I played a similar role at Justin Bieber magazine, where I was the anti-Bieber columnist, and it wasn't easy, but someone had to raise concerns about...
It didn't even last that long.
Yeah, yeah.
Graham Weiss, Governing magazine.
Yeah. Matt, I have a question for you, and Jamie, I think you were sort of, this will apply to you as well, but, you know, you are both conservatives who are critical of the president, who were not sort of on board fully with the Trump project, and, you know, I think there remains a space in the media for your voices, but, you know, I do think you're right that the incentives are probably against, holding fast to those stances, those principles. And, you know, I think a lot of us either have or at some point will face a moment where the zeitgeist is kind of against where your conscience might, you know, take you. And I'm just curious, like, if you could talk a little bit about how you've navigated that and how, and it's funny, on the Never Trump commentary question, I think you've sort of seen it from both sides. You've seen folks who probably were critical of Trump who have sort of moved over and become fully supportive. You've also seen, you know, never Trump conservatives who sort of talk like Democrats now, you know,
right.
And which is also another form of You know, kind of going fully the other way. And I think it's fair to say both of you have just basically remained as kind of small government conservatives the whole time. So just talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I'll go first, but I would say I think Jamie may have the better of the stories because I think that something that happened to you was a turning point in many ways, in a lot of ways. But I'll just say, I think, look, you should do what's right, you should do what you believe, but from a purely strategic standpoint, Donald Trump's the worst thing that could have possibly happened to me. I had a book that came out in January of 2016, before the Iowa caucuses, called Too Dumb to Fail, where I was essentially warning conservatives and Republicans against the dangers of nationalism and populism and white identity politics and all those things. And my main premise was just that these things are bad and toxic, but there was also the implicit and their electorally death, which I still believe long term, but it's hard to make that argument when you win the presidency, you know, and you get two Supreme Court justices. So if Trump had lost, and trust me, I don't let that impact my coverage, but, you know, looking back, if Trump had lost, right now I would be one of the leading conservative voices telling conservatives and Republicans how they can win the future, how they can get the White House back. There would have been a Republican primary last night that I would have probably been covering in Houston, as opposed to sitting in an apartment in Alexandria, Virginia at 1 o'clock in the morning writing a column about it. So if Trump had lost, that would have been better for me from my career standpoint. If Rubio had won, let's say, if he had become president, I think I would have also been poised to be a leading voice kind of championing Rubioism and this new sort of, I don't know what you would call, compassionate conservatism 2.0 or whatever it would have been. That would have been a pretty cool opportunity and something I think I would have been good at and well-positioned to do. And one of a handful of people, you know, there's others, but I would have been one of the people. I would have probably been like CNN's person. None of those things happen. And I think that, like, in your career, you can't plan. Like, you can put yourself in a position to thrive, but, like, I couldn't plan that Donald Trump was going to win and how that would impact my career. And so how do you stay employed? How do you stay relevant? And I think you're totally right. I have just as much respect, and by this I'm being sarcastic, the never Trumpers who suddenly have changed their views on everything, guns, environment, abortion, whatever. If Trump's for it, I'm against it. I have the same level of respect for those posers and panderers as I do for the formerly thoughtful Reagan conservatives who have drunk the Trump Kool-Aid and bought into the Trump cult. Because I think in both cases, they are not being intellectually honest. They are responding to incentives in a business. And here's what bothers me, and then I'll shut up. What bothers me is, if you're in the sports industry or the music, if you want to be Lady Gaga, bring it. You know, wear the meat jacket or the whatever that was, right? Be flamboyant. Be eccentric. If you want to be Neon Deion Sanders or Dennis Rodman, you know, get the tattoos, whatever, great. You're in the entertainment business. That's awesome. Politics is different because in politics, if you adopt a position, if you endorse a policy or a politician, ideas have consequences. And the consequence isn't just you getting rich, you getting famous, you getting a million Twitter followers. It has real life ramifications. And anybody who does that, I don't have time for. And that's what bothers me about it. Now, how do you stay relevant? That's when, I think it was Steve Martin who said, be so good that they can't ignore you or they can't say no. You just have to be good, and sometimes you're dealt a bad hand. And part of being a professional is being good enough to survive even when you have a bad hand. That's the challenge.
I'm just thankful, actually, for the era, because it pushed me towards something I actually am more interested in, which is these long-form conversations and understanding people who I even think perhaps are hypocrites or something like that. But, you know, what's interesting, I think, on my... it sounds like I'm plugging it constantly, but on my podcast is, I think you'll
rate and review on iTunes.
Yeah,
actually, I'm glad you are, because when the definitive sort of story of the Trump presidency is written, the interviews that Jamie has done on the show with people who are involved in the campaign, who are critics, who are all over the map, there's long form stuff there that's really valuable. I encourage us to listen.
Thank you. But what I would say was interesting is that even people that, you know, there'll be a section where I'm pressing them on maybe some contradictions. Well, how can you support this if you want support of that? But then we'll get to their life and their life story, and you'll find something you like about them quite a bit. So it complicates people. People are complicated. Their lives are complicated. You might hate what they say on TV sometimes, but they've maybe done things that are genuinely interesting and impressive in a different way. I don't know if I'd be doing these type of conversations had we lived in a different political era, and I'm glad I'm doing them. So in that way, I'm thankful.
Jack Jenkins with RNS.
So I'm going to ask this question, but like from a similar space, which I'll explain, which is that I write for Religion News Service now, which is kind of like a straight down the middle, you know, we're in association with the Associated Press, that sort of thing. But my previous job was at Think Progress. And so we probably wrote a lot of things about you guys. And Britt and I were commiserating about how similar the work is at the Free Beacon and Think Progress. But one question I get asked a lot when I used to work there, and I'm sure y'all have too, is, you know, polarization isn't something that all of us particularly enjoy. And the work that we both have done, you know, some people accuse has only accentuated that polarization. And I have my own response to that question, but I'm curious how y'all respond mm-hmm. to it, given you're still, in some ways, in the work, even though it sounds like you're trying to cut a different path, even in that polarization context. You know, when someone says to you, you're part of the problem, you help create the situation, how do you respond to that?
You know, I think that generally there's no question that partisan outlets have helped exacerbate situations, and it goes back to incentives. And those incentives are the things that get clicks at. I don't know if Think Progress was, you know, needed this, because I mean they were funded by a bigger organization. I guess they did. Looking at what happened, but the incentives are everywhere. It's not just in, partisan publications. It's on cable news. So that those incentives are there, and those push polarization. And what the candidates running for president get bigger responses for, they're not for, you know, saying, like, let's try to bring the country together right and left. That's not where they're getting, you know, made more donations. There's incentives to take whatever extreme there is position on both sides. So I think there, and that's, again, a theme of my podcast had been, what did the right do to help create kind of this environment? Certainly early on in the podcast. And I think there's legitimate criticism to go around there, and some of it, me personally, I'm sure, exists as well. Although, I was hardly so, I wish I was as influential. But I probably have some of the blame that would go around. Although I do think I even throughout my career would ask questions and you know, act in a pretty responsible manner. But certainly, I'm sure that hasn't always been the case.
Jamie,
every time
you wrote a book where you said the president was a lizard. Is that true?
It is true. So I also wrote satirical stuff, and I did some stand up and things along those lines. That book was called The Lizard King. But it made fun of people on all sides of the ideological spectrum. But I encourage you to read it. I think it might be a little out of date in 2020 or 19. I think the blame goes around in all directions. And I would say even in the mainstream media. Again, I had Chuck Todd on my podcast, and we were discussing, and other people kind of in the mainstream cable world, their tendency to focus on, you know, these issues, like I think the day I interviewed him, Michael Cohen got there's some small bit of news that no one can decipher, but they were going live with people that had no insight into this whatsoever, and they were going to go live for 4 hours. And that night on CNN, you know, even though there's a war in Yemen going on and there's all this stuff, they were going to have a panel of 33 people, all have some variations of law degrees from different universities and different ideological perspectives, talking about this minute issue for 4 hours. They can't possibly know exactly what it means, but they're going to go in-depth coverage. Now, is that polarizing things? I think it is, because they know on CNN that's what their viewers want, because they want something to lead to impeachment. And on Fox News, perhaps, they're going to have an in-depth special on Hillary Clinton's emails. So that's maybe what their viewers want in prime time. In different ways, that's leading to different aspects of polarization. But yeah, again, I think it all goes back to incentives, but I don't know how that is solved, because the incentives are what they are. And I'm not exactly sure how you get rid of them or change them in any material way.
What he said, I think that it's not just like partisan or ideological media outlets. I think that in general, the media, including the mainstream media, are really, I don't want to say a net negative, but they're increasing a lot of our problems and polarization, including, I don't think you get Donald Trump without the media. I mean, I think he was aided. And Jamie, one of the recurring themes of your podcast is asking really smart media observers whether Russia or the media gave a bigger donation to Donald Trump. And they all say the media.
Yeah. Actually, I just lost my train of thought, but I had something really, really insightful to add there.
Well, you think about it, and I'll just finish out with what I was going to say, which is, so then I, with that sort of as the preface, I will say, like, I don't hate the player, hate the game. And so I feel like Jamie and I are both a net positive within an industry that that is certainly questionable. I guess my thing is, we should all try. If you feel like you are a net negative, you should probably, you know, go into a different business.
So I remember my point and a second point. So, wow, you guys are in luck today. So, yes, you can blame kind of the incentives for it, but in the end, who's really to blame here? It's the people. It's the people,
yes,
for clicking. It's not the media. It's what people want. It's what they want. And that's where the incentives come from. I don't know how to change it. And I'll just give an example. I mean, you can go. I remember talking to a book agent recently about a couple ideas, maybe a couple years ago. And one of them was, you know, 50 most ridiculous people, something that's really highbrow, right? The 50 most ridiculous people in Washington. But I wanted to do like half the right and half the left or something like that. And they're like, I don't know about that. Who's going to buy that one? I mean, you got to give me a list of 50 of people and choose one side here. No, who's going to buy the one with half and half? There's just no interest unless like you're picking your audience. In rare occasions, yeah, exactly, right. Switch it up. Change my mind. Change my mind after it. Yeah.
Mini books work much better. Holly Meyer and then Christian Smith. Holly Meyer from the Tennessean.
Hi guys. There is a narrative that DC is in a bubble. And I wonder if you have a take on that. And then also, if that's the case, what do you guys do to make sure you're taking the temperature of what's going on in the rest of the country and balancing that with staying on top of the national news narrative?
I think there's a lot of bubbles. DC's one, but so is probably, you know, most cities in the country, because you're, you know, I'm sure someone in the Midwest knows about Midwest problems more than, you know, a lot of people in D.C. who live in a D.C. bubble. But, I think they probably live in their own bubble also. So, absolutely, I think bubbles exist all over the place. And what do I do? Again, I try to have these, get back to my podcast, these conversations with people, you know, all over the ideological spectrum. And often I travel to different places around the country. Now, I probably could do more to go to certain places that I'm not going to. But, you know, to puncture at least the political, ideological bubble, you know, I enjoy bringing on people that disagree with me, you know, severely. And I really appreciate when the conversation is civil and gracious and we have just a back and forth. So I try to, I think a lot of my listeners probably, you know, weren't super fans of Ta-Nehisi Coates, but they got a very different perspective and a really great conversation when we had Ta-Nehisi Coates on. So I guess that's what I'm doing, but I do think there's a lot of different bubbles.
Yeah, I think that's true, and D.C. obviously is a bubble. So I think part of this goes to what I was saying earlier about having family and friends and outside interests. That can be part of helping stay grounded in many ways, not just personally, but in terms of your worldview. For me, you know, luckily my mom lives in Pennsylvania. She didn't just vote for Donald Trump. She drove people to the polls for Donald Trump. One of the best interviews I did was having her on the podcast, asking her right after the election, why did you vote for Trump? Having people that you love and respect and that you know are good people who live in different parts of the country can be very important. Also, my wife and I, this is a recent thing, just in the past 3 months probably, started dividing our time between D.C. and West Virginia. And so I'm actually heading to West Virginia later today. And like I went to college in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. My wife's from that area. And it's not all that far, believe it or not, but it's also a million miles away. We've been going to a church in Charlestown, West Virginia, which is, it's not as lowbrow as it sounds, but it's technically some sort of fundamentalist is in the title of the denomination, or if it's even a denomination, it's unclear. And I've been going to like Sunday school there and going to church there. And then I guess lastly, you know, my wife and I just, we took our summer vacation was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I do think that we should try to do things like that to stay connected and grounded. And not only because it's the right thing to do, but I think just for my own personal benefit, if I'm going to stay, have you noticed a lot of my concern is staying employed. If I'm going to stay relevant, continue to have an interesting perspective and a voice and be a good commentator, I can't afford to be saying what everyone else is saying. And so by doing these things, by spending time in West Virginia, by having talking to family who are not in the D.C. bubble, that is it's part of the job as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, we got 15 minutes, so we're going to pivot to sort of the cable news 60-second answers that you guys are so good at.
Oh,
Chris Smith,
round.
You're up first, and then Brett Scher and Carly Stern.
I'm a sociologist, not a journalist. So I remember in a certain kind of golden era of neoconservatism, 1982, Michael Novak wrote this book called The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. And the basic idea was a good society needed to have separate spheres of life. Politics was politics. It should do politics. It should stay in politics. The economy was economy. It had its own logic. The market was a different logic than what politics was about. And then there should be this third sphere of, sort of what you can broadly call culture, religion, family, the arts, community, etc. And it should do its own thing. And each of those needs the other to do their separate thing in order for them to survive and to be good at what they're doing. Okay. What I'm hearing you say, I mean, what I observe generally, but I'm hearing it over and over and over here, is basically what's happened is that the logic and the engine of the economy has taken over all the other spheres. So politics has been, is being taken over by the rationales, the incentives, the energy, the underlying logic of the economic sphere. So there's a certain kind of colonization going on, which, according to his logic in 1982, would destroy politics if politics didn't have its own boundaries, its own semi-autonomy. In the 60 second, you can pare that down to 5 seconds if you want and say yes. Well, I'm just curious, like how you read that.
Well, I think that's an interesting observation. I would say yes, and it's not just the economic section taking over the others. I think they're bleeding all over the place. I think, you know, culturally, people are saying if you don't have, you know, these opinions, then, you know, politically, they're trying to tie culture and politics, religion and politics, and you have to have, like check the box on all three to be considered in some places like, a noble person. So I think they're, you know,
if you say, like, look, I really want to have these separate spheres, there's a section of our society right now that would say, no, you can't have these. I mean, these things should all be tied together. And you're seeing, I think, businesses get involved in politics more than they used to, companies. Used to be that CEOs would try to stay out of politics, but activists are trying to push them to take positions on issues. So I think these spheres are blending together, and it's not just because of, you know, the economic incentives, which I agree is a problem with kind of. And I don't think that's even a bleed over, really. That's just the nature of, you know, there's businesses. I mean, these publications are businesses. The media, the cable news is businesses. They're looking to make money and pay Matt and other people to keep his
job. That's important.
And to do that, you need to make a profit. And to do that, you have to get ratings or clicks or whatever.
Yeah. So there was a book I'm sure you read. I think it's called The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism. Daniel Bell?
Yeah, he was my graduate advisor.
There you go. So, as you know, I think the premise of that book is that it's a little bit ironic, but conservative, like capitalism, free markets actually undermine social conservative values and like communities, communitarianism. And so it's ironic because, during much of our lives, there's been this coalition of free marketers and social conservatives who were ostensibly allies. But these things actually are at odds. And I think that, unfortunately, what's happened in the media is that it used to be seen as a public service, and that there was a belief that that a well-informed citizenry was important for the republic and for democracy, and that was something that we would prioritize and that we would subsidize. At some point, it became monetized. It became about ratings, and I think that the internet really did a lot of damage to this, or kind of expedited this trend, I should say, because it used to be that we knew if someone bought the New York Times or not, but we didn't know if they read Matt Lewis's column in it. And so I could write a column about remembering the Armenian genocide, and that's an important thing to do, one could say, but it might not get a lot of readers. But nobody knew that, right? Because we didn't know if people read that piece or not. Well, now, because of technology, we have the ability to know, like without a shadow of doubt, which TV segments are getting ratings, which are not, which columns are getting clicks, which are not. And guess what? As Jamie suggested, the kind of things that get attention, that get buzz, that get ratings, tend to be like more salacious and do not tend to be things that unify us and unite us. And so, again, it goes back to all of these perverse trends. It is about entertainment, and I would agree that these spheres, we were better off as a civilization having them somewhat segregated, and now they are all together, and we are treating politics and information and democracy like we treat Nikes, and that's a problem.
30-second addendum. I do think there's something about this idea that between 9/11 and the decade that followed, there was this idea of a platform revolution that nobody saw coming. Michael Novak couldn't have seen that in 1982, but the idea was you went from a season where producers would control what was available to a season in which consumers allow. And that change, that pivot, has more radically affected all of our lives than perhaps anything else. And that's the thing, too, I think, about sort of airtime being sucked up, the oxygen, by
the amazing thing is that what you just described sounds great.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like I don't want to say I was a tech utopian, but I was much too optimistic about empowering people and getting rid of gatekeepers and disruption.
Let me say there's a problem. I mean, it's not like this was a utopian era. I mean, we talk about bubbles. If like the gatekeepers are all from the same bubble, then you're kind of feeding. So I mean, it wasn't like there was a utopian era before, but this supposed solution has caused a whole host of new problems.
Brent Scher from the Free Beacon.
This is kind of exactly what my question was on. I mean, I know you guys are both opinion journalists, but I guess because of the lack of gatekeepers, you two are opinion journalists who would probably get through a gatekeeper right now. But do you think there's just way too much opinion journalism on the, or opinion pieces, and way too many journalists who their idea of getting into journalism is, you know, telling everybody what they think at 21, 22 yeah, years old. And on both sides, you know, countless websites who would be willing to publish any opinion because of the incentives of, like, throw 10 opinion pieces against the wall and see which one sticks. I mean, do you think that's a
yes.
big problem?
Far be it for me to criticize. I mean, I was someone writing opinion pieces. I mean, I did opinion journalism well. I did, I think, some decent reporting. But, I mean, that's what Bob Novak. That would be advice he'd always give conservative audiences, like, you know, what should I do? Like, report. Don't write opinion. Yeah. But, you know, that, you know, if CNN headline news doesn't make as great a ratings as CNN regular, in part because, I mean, I think CNN headline news is mainly just, I haven't watched in a while, but, like, used to be just, like, headlines.
I don't know if it's there anymore.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that's a good point. So maybe, so the point, exactly. Exactly, yeah.
Incentives thing completely, yeah. That it's just what people want to hear, what people yeah. want to
right. So, like Kate Upton slideshows, you know, something.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I was going to say, which is that when we started at the Daily Caller, the idea was that most, like, the vast majority of the people there would be young reporters who would be, like, on the campaign trail or doing FOIAs and breaking news. And the idea would be, like, let's push that news to Drudge. And that will force the mainstream media to cover it, but it was original reporting. And I think over time, and again, don't hate the player, hate the game, right? They're responding to incentives. But I think over time, the Caller got away from that. And it's because it turns out it's not efficient to do that. Like, it's a lot cheaper for someone to just watch Hannity and pull a video. And you could be embedded on a campaign for days and interview a candidate and write a thoughtful, interesting news report about that, maybe even make a little news, and it just won't do as good as waiting and hitting refresh and seeing what Donald Trump tweeted and being the first person to write the column about that. That is basically, back to the economics, driving this whole thing. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Capitalism just doesn't work.
He's joking, I think.
Carly Stern.
So a little bit along the lines of the economics, we talked about, back to Holly's question, like geographical bubbles. There's obviously a media concentration on the coast, and then obviously we've also talked about how to stay gainfully employed, and that comes down to kind of the unsustainable business models, which seem to all be connected. So my question is, like, if you could really start the media industry from scratch, how would you structure the concentration of where the media is such that journalists could cover the country, like, comprehensively and thoroughly? And if that sort of reduced the relative power of the D.C. media, like, would you still make that choice?
Oh, well, it's a tough one. This is where I say I don't know.
I could run from West Virginia, Matt. It'd be perfect.
Yes. Harper's Ferry, West Virginia bureau chief.
That's right.
For the Daily Beast. I've heard the theory that that what we really have is a geographical problem and that media outlets are based in New York and D.C., and that is the reason for the liberal bias, like, let's say, and the bubble, and that if we put, like, if they were, like, in Omaha and Davenport instead, I don't know if that's true, and I don't know if that's an overly simplistic solution. I will say I think that we are grappling with ways to fix the economics, which could have a downstream, like, salutary benefit. So, like, I can tell you, some outlets are just pure, like, for profit, right? And I think that does lend to more Kate Upton slideshows. Not that there's anything wrong with that, you know. I've looked through a few of those. Some of them are dabbling in, like, being supported by foundations, right? And so, but that could be good, but there's a potential downside to that too, right? Do those foundations have an agenda? Some of them are being supported by, like, a philanthropist, you know? That can be good, but these guys tend to, at some point, quit. At some point, they don't like to lose money anymore, you know, no matter how rich they are. At the Daily Beast, all of my columns are now behind a paywall for the at least for the first 24 hours. And I can tell you it's a little bit hard to get buzz on a story that you just wrote if it's behind a paywall. But amazingly, and nobody is more stunned than me about this development, but people are actually converting so that they can read my columns. I'm not surprised that they're paying for the beast. I'm surprised they're paying for my columns, which, again, nobody's more surprised than me. I don't know what the answer to that will be, but I do think that if we could find a way to make this business economically sustainable and based on some criteria other than, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, then that actually could end up resolving a lot of, maybe not the liberal media bias problem specifically, but a lot of the other problems that we have in the media right now.
It's an interesting question, but I mean, I think the realities are that if you're covering like national politics, like it doesn't really make sense actually to base it in, South Bend, Indiana, where I think you're a professor, right? Yeah. If you're covering the entertainment industry, like, well, it makes all the sense in the world to be in LA to cover that entertainment industry. If you're covering the financial system, like, well, the most place, I mean, there's stories everywhere, but like the most sense probably is where the Wall Street is or something like that. So especially, I mean, in politics, you want to get interviews with people that are running things. They're most concentrated here. So, I mean, I think you have to base it. Most outlets that are covering politics here, or at least national politics, maybe the real thing is diversity of the newsrooms in a certain sense. I'm arguing against interest here, but a lot of the newsrooms are filled with people who went to, you know, schools, elite schools on the East Coast, probably share very similar cultural and religious views of things and along those lines. So perhaps you draw more from other, you know, universities who probably can do just as great reporting as a lot of the people that are doing some pretty good reporting right now, and might have different think of different questions to ask and different assumptions that probably manifest itself in newsrooms right now.
I think you raised one really interesting point that I didn't even think of, which is I do think that because the media is such a low paying job. For so many, you know, especially kind of like cub reporters, you end up having a lot of rich kids who can afford to have their income subsidized by parents. You know, they have to move to New York or D.C. And so I think that you end up having, even if you have like a racially diverse, ethnically diverse, gender, even worldview diverse newsroom, you probably still have pretty rich people who are pretty privileged in that room.
I thought you were going to go with the speech from Bill Murray and Rushmore.
Take good aim on the rich kids.
Last closing and quick question or comment from courtesy at Sacktown Magazine.
So you guys have talked a lot about staying relevant while also staying gainfully employed. And it seems that we've talked a lot about the models that are in place in our industry seem to push us towards relevancy means staying up to date, always being busy on top of everything. And to me, that sounds just exhausting. There's so many things coming, not in every morning, but halfway through the day, towards the end of the night. It just seems like very tiring. And for people who are in that national news spotlight, how do you guys maintain a sense of sanity, of clarity above the kind of muck that seems to fill a lot of our time?
Well, I think your answer is probably more relevant. I mean, since the 2016 election, kind of my foot is in the journalism world is my podcast. So I'm not as kind of writing columns and doing other things like Matt is. So he's probably, I mean, I stay on top of it because I don't like myself for it, but I do enjoy kind of politics and reading about it and staying on top of it. So it's not like a hassle for me to do that. But I'd be interested to hear what Matt says.
So some of the best advice I ever got came from our friend and former boss, Tucker Carlson. Jamie and I had this weird, experience of working for 6 or 7 years for Tucker Carlson. and having him just show up at the office and debate us, especially you, about politics. And he was talking, we were talking during breakfast about some of the horrible advice he gave interns, like telling them to quit college and you know, stuff like that. But he also had some really profound and insightful advice. And he told me, it sounds like bad advice, but it's great advice. He said, if you want to survive in this business, the key is you have to get famous. And I say it's profound because it sounds like stupid and obvious, and but he's kind of right. And I think what he meant by that is this is not a good business. It's not really sustainable if you just want to be a cog in the machinery. If you're just going to show up and do what your boss says every day and punch a clock, it's not going to pay that much. The hours aren't going to be great. You're not really, maybe it's going to be tough to have a family but if you can get 100,000 Twitter followers, and I'm using the term famous very loosely at this point, if you can develop a reputation and get a little momentum, a little juice going, then you can negotiate a better deal. You can. I think when I worked at the Daily Caller, I think I showed up at like 7:30 in the morning and I left at like 2 o'clock every afternoon. That's a pretty good gig. But you didn't get that job like out of the gate. I was a little bit older, a lot older than most of the people there, and I was able to kind of negotiate that. Are there trade-offs? Yeah. I mean, I'm probably not going to get the Pulitzer. I think my debate coverage last night probably warranted it. I don't think it's ever going to happen because I'm not a workaholic. I do think there was a point in my career where, do you remember at some point Ben Smith went to BuzzFeed from Politico and he started hiring all these young up-and-coming, at the time, young up-and-coming journalists. And out of the gate, they were just tweeting up a storm. I think it was like the 2012 presidential campaign. They were all over it. If Mitt Romney coughed, they had a story about it. I mean, and it hit me like, I can't compete with these guys. They're faster than I am. They're more on the road more than I am. They're better, they're smarter than I am. I can't. If I play their game, if it's who can cover Mitt Romney's campaign or Barack Obama's campaign, every single thing, all the minutia, like I can't compete. And so it would be stupid of me to try, right? And so what I did was, I literally said, I'm going to spend half of my time writing. My job, and the other half of my time I'm going to grow my social media following, like actually work on that strategically, and I'm going to read. I'm going to spend time during the workday when I ostensibly should be working, reading and learning, because I had a really crappy education. And that was an investment that I made because I figured there's always going to be a crop of young, new kids out there who can stay up later than me and tweet faster than me. I can't compete with them. But if I start to accumulate wisdom and knowledge and experience, they won't be able to. That's the one thing they can't compete with me on. And so what is my competitive advantage? That, I think, is important. You're always going to be reinventing yourself. You're always going to be trying to grow and figure out how to I've been saying stay relevant, but how to continue to contribute in this business and to help other people. And it's tough.
But I'll just add, I do think there's actually a role, though, for like subject matter experts. If your beat is economics or something, you may sometimes look up and say, like, why is that idiot on TV talking about like my story? But if people need like subject matter experts sometimes, and a lot of the times, and a lot of these publications demand it, and they hire for it. They're looking for who's the best reporter in a certain sector. I mean, Taylor Lorenz, who just got she's been following social media. She's become like the expert on social media. She's like keeps going from, but now she's at the New York Times. So I don't know you have to be, TV famous to make it. I think if you become the best at covering something, there's definitely a role because newspapers still have to come out.
All my advice is premised off of the expectation that I will never be an expert on any public policy, you know, position, but that is very true.
Working at it. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you. Thank you.